This is Red Ice Radio, a beacon of sanity from Northern Europe. RedIceCreations.com.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for being here listening to Red Ice Radio. I'm Henrik Palmgren, and we are coming to you from up north, Sweden, on the Scandinavian Peninsula. If you're new to the program, this is radio dedicated to exploring and unraveling some of the mysteries of this world. We continue to pursue the truth and investigate research in many different fields. And you can find more on our website, RedIceCreations.com. And you can subscribe at redicemembers.com for our full archives. Today we're talking with Randy Powell about vortex-based mathematics. He began his study after searching for the name of God. We're going to talk about Randy's background in the beginning, so you'll get up to speed on exactly how he got involved and what his interest in all of this is. We'll advance forward and discuss the application of the knowledge of this new kind of math, including the background on the numbers 1 through 9 and how they relate to each other. We are also going to talk about black holes, the Abha coil, as Randy calls it, or the vortex coil, and if applied right, what some of the possibilities are when it comes to new free energy technologies and over-unity. Welcome, Randy. Good to talk to you. Thank you for coming on Red Ice Radio. Great to finally have you on. I've been familiar with your work, and of course, ever since we had Marco Rodin with us back in January 2008, that you've kind of picked up on his work. So this is going to be great to revisit this topic once more and discuss it further with you and introduce it to our audience. So thank you for coming on again, Randy.
Thank you very much, Heinrich. It's a pleasure to be here.
So, as I said, Marco Rodin, obviously, some of our listeners will probably be familiar with him and his work. I don't think we should assume that everybody is, though. So maybe we can begin there and talk a little bit about Marco, how you got involved in his work. And then obviously later we'll get into the specifics of vortex-based mathematics. But how did you hook up with Marco, and when did that happen, Randy?
Well, The truth is, this is a really great experience for me to come on your show. As I was referring to you before, it was actually through your show that I first encountered Marco's work. It was a really strange experience. I had been working quite a lot with numbers and geometry. Through various synchronistic kind of experiences, maybe we can go into in a little bit, I was really sure that the number 9 was the answer that I was looking for to the problems that I was working on. And I had just actually told my brother that when I understood how these basic numbers were creating geometry, which I was certain that they were, then I would really have the secret that I was looking for. And that the morning around the time when you had done that show with Marco, I was at work early one morning, and I was working at a gym, and you know, there wasn't a lot of people around. And I've been reading the Emerald Tablet online, or a version of it. And you know, I came to this part, and it said, if you want to understand the meaning of the infinite number 9. Then you have to chant this word, and it gave this word, and I just thought, well, you know, what the heck, I'll just go for it. And so I chanted this word all morning to myself, and immediately when I stopped, within 60 seconds, my phone rang, and it was about 9 a.m. at that point. And it was a friend of mine who I'd never talked to on the phone, certainly not at 9 a.m. in the morning, and he called me, and he just said, hey, man, you know, he's like, to tell you the truth, I have no idea why I'm calling you right now. But he's like, I just heard this interview with this guy, Marco Rodin, on Red Ice. And he goes, to tell you the truth, I didn't have any idea what he was talking about. But it just sounds like something that you would be interested in.
Right.
And, you know, he said, it reminded me of you. So you should go check it out. And so that afternoon, I went and actually watched Marco's video on YouTube, and within about the first 5 minutes, I understood exactly what was going on. And yeah, it was a pretty amazing experience. And since that time, you know, I spent quite a little bit of time there in the beginning, really studying and grading the work, doing a lot of work on my own. And then Marco and I met and started to become friends more on a personal level, just kind of, I was just checking up on him and being a friend. And then at some point I made a tremendous breakthrough in the math that I realized was completely redefining the way that all of this was understood and to be understood. And so initially I contacted Marco and said, "Hey man, you know, I didn't expect to do this, but it turns out I made a big breakthrough in the math." I tried to start sharing it with him, and because of the position that he's been in, he just said, "You know, you really just got to publish or perish, you know." He said, I'm just not in a position to be able to review it at the moment. And so you should just put up videos and put it out there. And that's what this project is about, you know, sharing. And so I put those videos up. Actually, it was the advanced vortex math video that's out there, which was the first one shot. And then after that, we did a kind of redo of the basics, a lot of which is covered in Marco's original videos. And then going into the beginning of the work that I did in vortex-based math, and now that those videos have even been several years ago now.
Yeah.
I mean, my talk's over 2 years old, and those videos were up quite a bit before that. And so in that time, those discoveries have become rather exponential and sort of avalanched into a whole new realm of understanding in this. And that's not to say that we don't have a long, long way to go, but it really did open a lot of doors in terms of how the connections we can start making with science and in the periodic table and various things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So that was initially how I got introduced to Marco. And you know, we just had a lot in common. We had a very similar background. In fact, people always joke us all the time, you know, because this Jonas Salk had told Marco that he thought his work was so advanced that in order for it to be understood in his lifetime, he would have to clone himself.
Right.
And
yeah.
Everybody always talks about how me and Marco look alike.
You sure do. That's right. Interesting.
Daughters, Venus and Cloud, are always saying, coming up to me going, "You look just like our dad," you know, and, and so it's become this kind of joke about me being Marco's clone. But but yeah, we connected on a lot of different levels, and that, you know, helped us to be able to work together to push forward the understanding of what we're doing. And so here we are now.
That's right. Here we are now. There's a lot of components to this. And we should spend some time here in the beginning, obviously, covering the basics and get people up to speed. And there might be even some graphics or images that we want to refer to, some slides here that we're going to have up on the program page, if so. But again, we can also reference people, obviously, to our interview that we did with Marco Rodin back in 2008, and there is videos, etc. But just for now, and just for the basics, vortex-based mathematics, What is this, and define it for us and just lead us into it for those who have no clue whatsoever, Randy?
Sure. Well, the name vortex-based mathematics was actually given to this work by a scientist who had looked at it, like a lot of the names and terminologies that we use now actually didn't even come from Marco or from myself. They were names that scientists put on this to try and relate it to the things that they know about. But I almost hesitate to use the term mathematics because people tend to have math phobia and to have a lot of negative associations connected with their math experiences in school. Not everybody.
Sure.
But that certainly seems to be a common thread. And I consider that what I'm doing to be much more akin to art, and true art in the sense that that it is a penetration into the deeper aspects of reality. But I approach it and I teach it through trying to relate it to very simple and easy to understand things. and primarily just through beauty. But, you know, going back to Marco to try and explain how some of this began for him, since he is the founder of this project.
Yes.
Marco's work started around the time he was about 15 years old. And when Marco was a little kid, he learned how to imitate the sound of the cuckoo barrel, which was on the Tarzan, old Tarzan movies, you know. And he used to just love to make this, you know, crazy bird call. And he noticed that the sound was affecting him, that it was affecting his energy levels, that it affected his dreams, and that it made him come alive to the point where it seemed to him that his peers around him were almost lifeless and dull because they weren't doing this. And, you know, that idea kind of resonated with him, stuck with him throughout his life. When he was around 15, he said he really wanted to try and get an understanding of what was going on in reality. And he read a lot of the most advanced books of the scientist Arthur Eddington and many others. But, you know, he felt that to keep up with the amount of information and innovation going on at the university level through analysis would be a genuinely impossible task in terms of trying to gain some essential understanding of what reality is and how we can work with it. And so he performed this thought experiment where he asked himself, you know, he put it out there to the universe to know what is the secret of intelligence. And so he decided to do this thought experiment. It sounds kind of funny, and I'm sure some of your listeners will raise an eyebrow, but he performed a thought experiment where he said, he wanted to take the smartest human being that he could think of, and Marco's 57 now, so this is 42 years ago. He wanted to take the smartest human being that he could think of and then put them in a debate against the smartest alien from a distant galaxy. And so his representative that he thought was the smartest man in the world at that time was Henry Kissinger.
Oh, wow. Well, that's an IRA. Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah. All right.
Yeah, it's a long time ago. you know, he chose Henry Kissinger, and you know how Henry Kissinger talks. You know, it can be very, I don't know how you would describe that voice.
But, very put on German accent, I would say.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like a villain out of a Bond movie, but yeah, go ahead.
Right. And so, you know, Kissinger's having this debate with the alien, but as he's talking, Marco realizes, you know, he's not contriving what he's saying. You know, he's just being lucid and intelligent. There's something free flowing about it. It's spontaneous, and he wants to know what's inspiring all of this. You know, we've all felt this before, you know, when you say you're just on, or, you know, it's the force is with you or whatever, mm-hmm. and, you know, that energy is present. And he was trying to penetrate into what is the source of that energy of inspiration. And he slowed the time down in his mind. And as Kissinger finished his sentence, he zoomed in on Kissinger's lips. And as he was beginning to say, before he began the next statement, there was a sound that came through his lips, this particular sound. And the quality of that sound shocked Marco to such an extent that he said he was laying in his sister's bed, and he said he shot straight up, you know, like Dracula out of the coffin, said, "I understand." And what he understood was that it was the language, it was the sound harmonics that was forming the brain, and that was the secret of intelligence. And so, you know, he ended up finding these studies that were done at UCLA where they actually did a lot of research on this, and I'll try to get you some articles on that. It led him through the search throughout all the world's different religious traditions to try and get at the heart of what they were doing. And what he found is that the most treasured thing within every religion is the name of God. Some people don't even pronounce it because it's so holy to them.
Yeah.
Others look at it as something that you should be very intimate with, and that it's meant to be said and pronounced. And so Marco was looking for the secret of the name of God. And as some people know who are familiar with our work, you know, eventually that led him to a religion known as the Baha'i faith, which is a Baha'i is one who follows Baha. And Baha'u'llah was a prophet from Iran from around the last 200 years, the early to mid 1800s. And, you know, lived the majority of his life in prison, gave up a life of wealth and luxury in order to bring forth a message which he felt was important at the time. And the great majority of that, for anyone who's ever read his mystical writings in particular, was revolving around this word and this most great name of God that he claimed in no uncertain terms was the secret of all sciences, was the hidden protected energy which God used to animate and create the universe. He even goes as far, and this was before the creation of the steam engine, I believe, he went as far as to say that if you could tap into this energy, you could produce a power which required no fuel and produced no fumes. And he associates it with the mathematics of this word, Baha, which is the equation of which is 2151 in the Abjad numerical system. As many people know, the ancient languages like Hebrew or Arabic, Aramaic, Farsi, Sanskrit, they have numbers that coincide with the letters in the languages, sometimes referred to as numerology.
Yeah.
And but it was a real art in the ancient languages, and it was different because the vowels weren't written in those languages. And so their languages were literally constructed mathematically. And so Baha represents the equation for this physical world that we live in, and that's the comparative case of the word. The superlative or the supreme case of the word is called Abha, and now these coils that many people are producing based on my mathematics are referred to as the Abha coil. Abha is represents the spiritual world within this world, and the name equals the number nine, and Baha'u'llah goes on and on throughout the scriptures referring to this number nine and how it represents God's sacred energy.
Mm-hmm.
And so that is what began, you know, essentially it was within several days later that Marco created this diagram, which is on my presentation under slide 20. And as many people are familiar with, some people call it the symbol of enlightenment. Marco created this symbol through a decryption of that most great name of God. And the reason that he did it was to try and understand how to say it correctly, how to pronounce it, how to make this sound that would be the secret of intelligence. And so literally he began with two lines cross-sectioning a circle, and then he just drew parallel lines to each of those lines. And so really what you're looking at in that symbol is just two sets of parallel lines. And it developed into everything that's being seen now, into a truly profound quest for inexhaustible energy from the vacuum, or however you want to look at that, what people call free energy, and has been now filtered through some of the best scientists, and we're starting to broach a lot of the universities. I think will reveal itself in the future to be one of the most tremendous mathematical discoveries of all time. So it's a strange and bizarre story how it began, and my own story of how I connected with it is no less strange and bizarre, and yet the results speak for themselves. So my axiom with it is you can't argue with success.
All right, interesting. Well, I think we should talk a little bit about your own story and how you got into it, but that explains, because I wanted to ask you about your website titled the abhakingdom.com, and that explains the Abha that you mentioned there. So were you ever into the Baha'i faith, by the way, before we talk about your story?
I wasn't previous to meeting Marco or encountering his work, but it does intersect with my life in a very profound and interesting way. I am an avid reader of the writings of Baha'u'llah, and I guess from a mystical perspective, I completely agree with what he's talking about and saying. But it just, maybe it's the arc of my own life or whatever. I have just have chosen to sort of walk my own path, and I've just never been a very good joiner. So I don't really go around saying that I am a Baha'i in that sense.
Sure. Yeah. Well, I think we're going to agree with the certain philosophies and spiritual truths, and we don't have to, go join the church, if you know what I mean, either. So, yeah, I agree with you.
There's nothing wrong with that as far as I'm concerned. It's to each his own, you know, or her own.
Sure.
My path has really been much more in line with, I guess, what a lot of people would refer to as shamanism.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, a lot of people will say that's an artificial term in and of itself. I'll just explain to you a little bit, very briefly, my story and how I intersected with this. And some people who are familiar with me have heard this story before, so they'll have to forgive me and hear it again. But
that's fine. We'll bring everybody up to speed here. So go ahead, Randy.
Sure. So my journey really started when I was about 4 or 5 years old. My father passed away when I was about 2.5. And so I grew up really with this strong awareness of death and trying to understand what happens to our essence when we die or what is the other side, and having a sense that there was some other side there. And it really wasn't coming from religion or anything, even though my parents were mildly religious Methodists, went to church on most Sundays. But I got really interested around 4 or 5 in this question of what does a human soul look like? What is the image of a human soul? And I knew that the physical body would decay and that there was something left in us which left the body and went to a higher realm or ascended. And a few days later, I went to the hospital with my mom to visit somebody, and I saw this image of a caduceus, which is, the twin serpents wrapped around a staff, sometimes called the sign of Hermes, with the wings at the top.
Yeah.
Or the medical symbol or the symbol of commerce, different names for it. I saw this image, and immediately it struck me as the answer to my question, that this was the image of a human soul. And so it made sense to me that it would be over the hospital where I thought they must be extracting them and sending them on their way. So I didn't ask anyone about it. That just was the answer to my question as far as I was concerned at the time. And so pretty soon after that, I was sitting in church with my parents one day, and I was just kind of meditating or zoning out, closing my eyes. I didn't really know what meditation was, but I was looking within myself, and I started to wonder, where does this caduceus exist in the body? And what I found was that it existed right down by the base of my spine. That's just where I saw it or imagined it in my mind, that it was just sort of sitting there dormant. And my next question was, well, what happens when you die? And I had this vision that the serpents would awaken, that they would wind their way up my spine, and when they went into my brain, the wings would open and this light would be released, and my head, the top of my head would open, and the caduceus would fly out of the top of my head. And I followed it as it flew into the atmosphere and flew up into heaven, where it landed on cloud 9. And, it's a weird imagining at that age, but, sort of everything is when you just have that kind of an open mind. And I think I got the cloud 9 thing from the show Bewitched, that old show where whenever they would go to the spirit world, they would go to cloud 9. And so what happened there was that as I was laying there on my cloud 9, looking around at all these other caduceuses on their cloud 9s, I started to become concerned that this must be a boring reality to exist in for eternity. And I was a little bit concerned for my father. And so I wondered, what do you do here? And at that point, I saw this great light in front of me in my mind, and I thought, well, this must be the light of God, and this is what you do. You look into the light of God. And when I looked into that light, I had this amazing mystical type experience, or experience of what I can only describe as all of eternity condensed into a single instant. And it was so overwhelming that it literally scared the hell out of me and made me jump up out of my seat and just not want to think about that anymore. I then later, began to associate this idea of eternity in a moment like that with this other symbol of the serpent known as the Ouroboros, or the serpent, swallowing its own tail. And so I had all these images and symbols in my head as a small youth like that. But, and I lived a normal childhood in so many respects. But that always kind of stuck with me as just some kind of thing that I had been through at that age. And, I forgot about a little more in my teenage years, but towards my later teenage years, I encountered a book on yoga. And when I picked that book up and I started flipping through it, all of a sudden I start reading and seeing this image. I actually have a picture of that. It's on image 26. I have, I've seen an image of a man with a caduceus inside of his body, and they were calling it the Kundalini. And they showed this exact same process of, as you awaken towards enlightenment, that this serpent winds its way up the spine and then exits through the crown of the head, where you go on to the higher realms. And this just blew my mind. I mean, it was an absolute confirmation to me out of nowhere that I had tapped into something collective as a child, and I remembered it.
Mm-hmm.
And so that led me on a journey through searching through all the religions and things I could find as I began to study what's classically called shamanism, or, like in the works of people like Eliade. And I was noticing that, people from all over the world were describing the same types of experiences. And he goes into great detail in that book about the number 9 and how it relates. And everywhere you see these images of the caduceus and the Ouroboros, in so many different cultures around the world. And I became fascinated by that. So I was really attached to these three concepts of the caduceus, which I was already onto the fact that maybe that had something to do with DNA, and the Ouroboros, and then the number 9. And so, a long story short, eventually, after many, many years, that led me into studying in the mystical traditions of the Middle East. And I was married at the time with a Muslim girl in my early 20s. And, I got heavily involved in the Sufi tradition.
Mm-hmm.
And, people have different images when they think of Sufi, but the people that I'm talking about were, in every sense of the word, traditional Muslims, but also into the mystical side of their religion. So, what I got interested in, this was after years of studying Buddhist meditations and different things and traveling all around, going to Asia, and I still wasn't making the breakthroughs that I was looking for. And what I got introduced to in this tradition was this idea of reciting the names of God. And, after years of studying all of the philosophy in the world, which is what I did in college, I just realized that there was no way that I was ever going to get it intellectually. It's just so complex through language. And I realized through rhetoric and debate that language is very circular, and that argumentation is an art in and of itself. And if you just know how to corner people into certain statements,
sure,
win arguments.
Yeah.
And so, but it, the fact that I won arguments that I knew I was BSing on, confirmed to me all the more that language in that sense wasn't a reliable tool. And so I became interested in trying to tap into a mystical reality, and I got into this reciting of the names of God. And there was this great tradition amongst the Sufis that there was something called the Most Great Name of God, which they said would be revealed at the end of this age, you know, and that it would contain all the names of God within it. And I really connected with this tradition also because I believed that the mystical Islamic tradition was the one place in the world where, in a major world religion, you can see this exact connection with what people refer to as like classical shamanism. I mean, the Prophet Muhammad was found as a child, supposedly having his organs taken out by beings of light and cleansed and placed back into his body, which is classic shamanic type of experience, one that I've had myself. In altered states, he eventually goes on this mystical journey where he rides a spirit animal and encounters the ancestors of the prophets on these various levels, up until he encounters this world tree, which again connects to that image of the Ouroboros, this sort of interconnected vortex-like entity. And when he encounters that, when he moves beyond that, everything beyond that is what is beyond language or beyond words. But when you return from that, you get the power songs, you get the names of God, and you get the ritual of how to connect to that ecstatic realm. And so, you know, this is what led me eventually. By the time I came to Marco's work, I knew that when I found the answer, it was going to be the number 9. That it would reveal the secrets of these two different geometries of the caduceus and the Ouroboros, mm-hmm. which, you know, you can look at as being the DNA side of the work and the toroidal side of the work, even though they're very interconnected. Within 5 minutes of watching Marco's video, he's talking about the number 9. He's showing these geometries that I was looking for. And then he says, this is a decryption of the most great name of God, which I'd been searching for in these texts for years and years. And so right away, I just knew that this was the path that I was supposed to be taking. And of course, I had no idea at the time that I would end up sort of being a figurehead in this project and advancing the work as far as I have. So so that's a little bit of the sort of mystical and personal side of it, but now we're really taking that to the level of something that can be tested,
right?
And ultimately, that's what we found: that sound is the secret energy of the universe. You know, the easiest example that I always refer to is talking about black holes, because many people are interested in this notion, and they're always in the news. It's conventionally taught that the fastest thing traveling through the universe is light traveling through the vacuum of space, where it has, and it's not encountering resistance. And we know that light, once it gets inside of the medium, is slowed down, you know, the speed is slowed by the medium. Interestingly, sound has the opposite property for anybody who's ever studied it. Supposedly sound doesn't travel at all in a vacuum. And because there's nothing to vibrate, and the denser the medium that sound passes through, like the air moving in the atmosphere is generally moving at the speed of sound, and you know, the denser that the medium that you pass sound through, the faster that the sound travels, passing the vibration, because everything's packed more closely together.
Yep.
And so we know that a black hole is called a black hole because apparently the matter inside of a black hole gets so crushed down, so dense. I've heard it said that 100 million suns is the size of a pinhead. I don't know if that's true, but I've heard that said.
However they figure that, but yeah, sure, go ahead.
It's a good metaphor.
Yeah.
And, it's so dense that the escape velocity of light is not enough to escape it. And hence, all the light is trapped inside of it, and they call it a black hole. And what I, you know, have been trying to say is that, and this is Marco's teaching as well, and this has also been suggested by other scientists, that when you get into matter that's that dense, that sound is still penetrating that matter, and that the sound penetrating that matter at that point transcends the speed of light. And it becomes it's no longer a wave. It becomes what they refer to in quantum mechanics as a quasi-particle, or you know, you could refer to it as the true God particle.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the source of the geometry and symmetry which underlies everything that we observe in the universe. And it's all arising out of this hypersound, which, you know, you could literally connect to the word, if you will, or the fact that sound is at the foundation of creation and that creation is essentially musical. And then we found that numbers themselves are musical, and they actually explain even our music scales and harmonies and why they work the way they do. So it doesn't become this abstract, heady thing. It becomes something that very much connects with the most intimate and personal levels of our lives. And that's why I find it to be very beautiful.
Very interesting. What does that make a black hole, though? There's kind of a, could we talk about them as kind of an engine of creation, if they generate this sound? And does that spread out through the vacuum throughout the universe? Or what is a black hole then?
Sure. Well, a hole is literally the zero. It's not a number on any multiplication series, but it's an absence. And what it is it's a lip. So whenever you have a vortex moving or a rotating system, and this is why there's issues with the pi and numbers like this, even though people like Marty, who you've had on your show, is a friend of mine, you know, have showed that there's even some symmetry within those numbers. But the reason I see it as fallacious is because a straight line will never pass through the center of a circle like that, because any rotating system will deflect things off of the center. It'll warp them and curve them around its axis.
Mm-hmm.
And so the hole is literally an absence. It's an axis that everything is being spin arrayed around. And so when you have a black hole, it's simply the northern half of a rotating system, which is collapsing everything in at the top and compressing it and accelerating it. And when it reaches its maximum acceleration is, I believe, when this sound begins to transcend the speed of light. And at that point, the matter is immediately removed from that center point by being exploded out the bottom half, which is called a white hole, or the Big Bang would be an example of one of these mm-hmm. systems.
Yeah.
So that creation is happening all the time, you know, boom to bang. And you have an implode-explode system, which when you look at technology, And I always say technology is something which is created with a purpose. And so when you start to see nature as technology, you know, its purpose is very much revealed. And I look at the universe as an engine, as a technology in that way, as you referred. And when I started to look at technology, I realized, you know, we're already using this in the technologies that we use, this idea of implode to explode or expansion and contraction, even in refrigerators. And, you know, it so happens to be that the common problem in most all of our high-tech stuff is temperature regulation. I mean, that's what's preventing us from having fusion. That's what's making the supercomputers hard. Even the particle accelerators have to be cryogenically frozen and all this.
Yeah.
To create these artificial environments to get rid of the friction. But, you know, the truth is, I believe that this system, implode, explode, black hole to white hole, the torus or the donut, which even by mainstream scientists like Howard Bloom is now being suggested must be the mechanism behind creation in the universe, that it is essentially a temperature regulator, just like our human body. And so it becomes the philosopher's stone of technology. Because it can solve all of the issues we're facing with one model.
Should we talk a little bit about the main symbol as a kind of a visual reference to describe the model, if we can? And I don't know if we should go through the numbers 1 through 9. What do you think is the most simplest way to describe this for those who haven't seen it or heard about it before?
Okay, well, I think, you know, as far as the explanation of the numbers and how they work, if people are really interested in that, there's a lot of videos up online where you can really get into that, because I think I'm going to do it a little bit of injustice over the radio, even though people can look at the visuals. But I'll talk quickly about some of the aspects of that. And I'll also send you an animation, Heinrich, that people can look at, which will show some of this in motion.
Yeah, yeah.
Helps kind of put it together.
That's right.
Really, when you look at the symbol, you have two different aspects that are really important. And this dichotomy or this duality, even though you might say it's really more like a trinity, is really at the heart of everything that we study in both science and even philosophy, as far as I'm concerned. And, you know, you have these two different aspects. One is this kind of what we call the lazy eight or the infinity symbol. And it's connecting the numbers 1, 2, 4, 8, 7, and 5, and then back to 1. And this pattern, 1, 2, 4, 8, 7, 5, is really significant because, as you'll see in the videos, it's making a doubling sequence. So to explain that quickly, 1 doubled is 2, 2 doubled is 4, 4 doubled is 8. 8 doubled is 16, but we have a 7 there, but we say 6 plus 1 equals 7. Now, the reason briefly why we do that, you know, sometimes it's said that that's superstition or numerology, but it's also used in science and math all the time. They just call it by more technical names like decimal parity or digital roots or, you know, all right. This kind of stuff.
Yep.
But numerology is fine with me. It's essentially to determine the underlying pattern beneath the number sequences. And that there is a pattern, and this exists even in prime numbers, which is what a lot of my work has proven, which is said not to have a pattern, but it does, and it's very easy. So 6 and 1 is 7. 16 then doubled is 32. 3 plus 2 is 5. 32 doubled is 64, and 6 plus 4 is 10. 1 and 0 is 1. Then it goes to 128, which comes back to 2. 256, 4. 512, which is 8. As far as you double forever, you will never break that pattern. 1, 2, 4, 8, 7, 5. 1, 2, 4, 8, 7, 5. And that's really significant because doubling happens to be at the core of so many things in math and science. You know, first of all, I always tell people, you know, when you're conceived, you have one cell that becomes 2, 4, 8, 16, 32, 64, right? And then they split apart into individual cells. So literally, you come to this earth, you came to Red Ice Creations today through a doubling sequence. So did I. And so it doesn't get more personal than that, but it touches many other aspects. Even chaos theory found that when studying apparently random patterns in economics, that when they were scaled over time, that they produced coherent doubling. And that was at the heart of chaos theory. And in so many ways, this symbol that we're showing reveals what's called the Koch curve or something like that, mm-hmm. which is where chaos theory was founded and all that. Anyway, interestingly, if you go backwards, it's still coherent. Like if you start with 1 and you say half a 1, then it's 0.5, right? Going back to the 5. And half a 0.5 is 0.25, which equals 7. Half a 0.25 is 0.125, which equals 8. Half a 0.125 is 0.0625, which equals 4. You know, so halving, you can go backwards towards it forever. And you'll never get to the end of it and will never break that pattern. And this is what we call the bounded infinity. The bounded infinity is what all physical mass is bound to. It is a frame of reference for everything. So when relativity says there is no preferred frame of reference, that's actually false. There is always a preferred frame of reference. Even in the solar system, in the galaxy, in the whole universe, there is an up, down, left, and right. And that is how you can actually use this to learn how to navigate in space. And it's why it's the secret of the gyroscope, why things stand upright when they spin. We call it the z-axis or the vertical lift. And so this system represents a spin continuum. It's a bounded infinity. It's an infinity of duration, but not an infinity of direction. Okay, it's not linear. It's a warp and a curve, which is what relativity proved that, you know, physical creation does. Even a photon from a distant star is warped by the gravity, right?
Yep.
So you have this system, 1, 2, 4, 8, 7, 5, which in our in vortex-based mathematics represents the underpinning geometry of the universe, which is essentially hexagonal, six-pointed. It's making a waveform. All right. Now, if you're most of physics traditionally has always been the study of matter and motion, and the materialists would like us to believe that that's all there is. Matter and motion, simply things colliding together, has created everything that we're now experiencing. But the missing element is this red pyramid in the symbol. And the red pyramid represents what can most generically be referred to as the field. So in science, you really have two things that you can study. You can study matter or mass, or you can study fields. Now, matter, you know, we have a fairly easy time dealing with. It's pretty predictable, you know, and it does certain things. But fields are much more interesting and mysterious and seem to have qualities which even defy some of our standard laws of physics. And fields, to me, are at the source and at the heart of creation. And now we, in science, they have many different types of fields. They have gravity fields and magnetic fields, and they have strong and weak force and quantum fields and all this different type of stuff, Higgs fields. I believe that there really is just one field. Okay, you can measure it at various strengths and in various qualities in various situations, and that depends on the system because all of our numbers always come in equal proportion. But you know, an easy way to look at it, we have first what we see on there is the 3 and 6. These represent magnetism. All right. So you have electricity, which is essentially matter in motion, electrons moving through a wire.
Mm-hmm.
One example. And that follows that 1, 2, 4, 8, 7, 5 path, which means there's a geometry which things want to move upon in the path of least resistance. Magnetism is supposedly at the center of electricity, all right?
Yeah.
And magnetic fields have a unique quality, which is that they oscillate. And when you look at this 3 and 6, interestingly, if you take 3 doubled is 6, right? 6 doubled is 12, 2 plus 1 is 3. 12 doubled is 24, 4 plus 2 is 6. 24 doubled is 48, which comes back to 3. You can go on and on and on. When you double these numbers, it just goes 3, 6, 3, 6, 3, 6, 3, 6.
Huh, so they relate to each other in that way, and they're therefore separate from the other numbers in the way that they relate to each other with doubling. That's interesting.
Exactly. They're an interconnected but distinct system. And the numbers, in conventional math, they say that numbers do not explain geometry. Arithmetic doesn't explain geometry. And what we've done is unified arithmetic and geometry into a single model so that we say numbers are geometry. And it's very simple. The 3 represents a triangle, which is masculine. It's a vector. It's an arrow. The 6 is a hexagon, which is feminine and which is the counterbalance to the 3. And the 9 represents the central geometry, which we see at the top of the symbol, which is a diamond. Okay.
Mm.
And these happen to be the only 3 shapes that you can tile a surface topology with without any breaks. Triangles, hexagons, and diamonds, interestingly.
Mm.
But it is so actually been confirmed, and I have some slides on this that I can send you. It's been confirmed in scientific journals that magnetic fields do conform to those shapes of triangles and hexagons. And I've actually had several scientists send me pictures that they've taken in a laboratory showing those geometries revealed. So there is some confirmation of that notion. It's not just simply a conjecture.
Interesting.
But more interesting is the nine, right? That's what we were all trying to get to.
The secret of nine, yeah.
Right, you know, and we all know Odin hung on the tree for 9 days and nine nights, and he came back with the 18 power songs, right?
Yeah.
From the runes, and we all know these myths and legends from everywhere, and all the way up to Cloud Nine and Love Potion Number Nine. That's the essence of this discovery, is that you have electricity. At the center of electricity is magnetism, and at the center of magnetism there is another energy present, which is currently unobserved. It's known to be there. They call it dark energy, which is distinct from dark matter. But I've also referred to it by other names, and I get a lot of flack for this online because people think I'm just randomly throwing out words. But, you know, you can call it tachyons, which is supposed to be a particle which travels faster than light, which was featured in the Watchmen. They talked about the tachyons.
Right, yeah.
Monopoles, which Maxwell postulated to symmetrize his electrical equations, that would fit under this description. You can call it gravitons, which are supposed to be particles which are at the source of gravity, which this would also be that. And ultimately, we call them etherons, which is to distinguish it from the ether as a static stationary ether. What we found is that it's a pulse. It's a surge. It's the true source of the quantum level of reality. And it's quantum because it's discrete. Because of this energy, time is actually not a continuous flow. It's a series of discrete moments. And so there actually is a rate of time. I'm sure it's way faster than anything we've been able to measure.
Mm-hmm.
But there is, for the universe even as a whole, a rate of time, a metabolic rate, if you will.
I was referred to as a clock cycle from a computer. Is that what we're talking about?
Yeah, that I'm not familiar with that term, but I imagine it's probably the same, that essentially it's like a movie. It's like discrete slices of information.
Yes.
Which rapidly put in succession to form what we experience as a waveform or a continuous flow, because it's faster than our flicker rate, you know. But this is actually very normal and logical for people to think about. And here's a clear example. Even if you reach over and pick up a glass of water, we see that as a smooth and continuous flow. But any person who studied biology or the brain will tell you, and you ask them, how does that happen? They'll say, well, you know, it's perfectly natural. There's a rapid series of electrical pulses which come from your brain, and they activate specific muscles which have what they call a firing rate, you know, or a muscle firing sequence. So there are specific moments where they're activated, and through that rapid succession of activated muscles, you're able to then generate continuous movement. But if you were able to get enough frames per second and observe it, you would actually see it as a very disjointed, discreetly pulsed sequence.
Yeah, choppy kind of.
Right.
Yeah.
That's what time is. And nine is at the source of that. It is the source of all time, motion, or vibration. And it creates the spin continuum or the bounded infinity of creation. And this is why you'll never get to absolute zero, because there's always some level of this energy present. There's always some amount of vibration occurring, however minute. So you can speed up time or slow it down, right? But you can never completely arrest it. And that's why we also believe that you cannot travel backwards in time.
Huh.
Even though you could travel forwards in time.
Okay.
But maybe that's a good place to let you come back in there so I don't get on too many tangents.
No, sure. It's very interesting. Much more to discuss. I think we could take a short break here in a little bit, and there's some couple of things we want to get in before that, of course, talking more about your websites, your YouTube channel, where basically people can find out more. And also, tell us about the film, by the way, that you have upcoming, and how's that, how that's going. At the moment, you don't have a trailer for it, but it's probably going to be available by the time we put up this program. So tell us about that. What is the film about?
Sure. As far as the website and everything, just so people can get that, my website is theabhakingdom.com. That's theabhakingdom.com. And unfortunately, that website hasn't been updated in several years. It was built for me by a friend, and I've never really even touched it. So there's so much new information, which is going to be going up now that I'm starting to get a little support to do this film. And we've got some web designers who want to contribute and help us put things up. It's really important that people understand that our project is an open source. We've never made money off of it. It's something that we believed in, even though we've had a lot of offers to work with different companies, and I could have made money in the technology sphere. It's been really important to me that this information stay open to the public, and that's why I'm approaching now the entertainment world to try and find simpler, easier ways for us to generate revenue to support the project so that we can continue and that we can advance much more rapidly. But it has to be done for me in a format which is open to everyone. So we will have updates coming there, and we're working on some open source software for that website where people can actually get involved and contribute more themselves. And we'll also try to have some sort of, I hate to use the word official, but some sort of reference where people can see what, you know, Marco or myself are saying about the math, as opposed to just all the different things that are out there. But we like to keep the research open and really to allow, not to censor anything, and to allow people to contribute what they conceive of as valid contributions to this. And because of that approach, we've created this great online community of people experimenting, building devices based on our math and showing amazing results. You know, Jack Scholes was one of the original ones who did the video that's on my TED Talk where he spun this neodymium magnet for minutes with no energy going into the coil.
Dude, that's really interesting. I want to ask you more about that later, by the way, but go ahead, Randy.
Yeah, and then... you know, Daniel and Erica Nunez, who've been doing a lot of great work with lighting systems and being able to create a tremendous amount of light for almost no energy consumption. And there's all kinds of bizarre effects there where actually the more load you seem to put on it, the more the power consumption goes down. So, you know, all kinds of great stuff. And people can just search Abha Coil, search my name, search any of these people, and you'll find all this stuff on YouTube. And we hope soon that we'll have a format for people to really be able to get that in a tight area where it's not so hard to track it all down. But, you know, all this is showing that the traces and evidence of this theory are there. And this is all like with Radio Shack quality equipment. So we're really trying to create revenue through entertainment in a harmless way where we can then start supporting hopefully a lab that will be open to the public, where all results will be published and shared freely. And just to create literally what I said in my TED Talk, which is a grassroots energy and technology revolution that cannot possibly be controlled. Even if someone were to come after myself or Marco, it wouldn't matter because the information is there in the hands of the public.
Yeah,
and it truly empowers the people in a different way. And so whatever the cost is of that, I feel like it's worth it. But with the film, we are going to be posting up a promo for that in the next few days. And we're doing a crowdfunding approach to being able to fund the film. We hope to raise around $500,000 to be able to do the whole project, which is a lot, but really in terms of a film is nothing, as I'm sure you know.
Well, that's right. I mean, you just put this into perspective, though, and consider how much complete bleeping junk that there is out there right now, that millions of American dollars are being poured into this I mean, come on, just half of one of these to the side of doing something that actually can change something for once, instead of just giving people a temporary little, maybe if even that these days, satisfaction of forgetting about their, you know, gray everyday life or whatever the point is of these movies anymore. So it's not really that much when you put it into context, Randy.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's very achievable if enough people even can give a dollar or anything like that. It's very achievable. We're going to keep our budgets very open, you know, and there are going to be some incentives for people who do want to contribute more in terms of being able to get even get some coils or things like that. So we're working on all those packages to try and make this a really valuable investment for people. But ultimately, what we're doing through the film is trying to take this information open source to a vast audience and to do it in an entertaining format. And we've got an amazing team. Thomas Jane, who's a well-known actor, has come on as a producer and become a good friend of mine. Who's really supportive of this work and sees the merit in it. You know, a lot of people might know him from The Punisher or some of these movies. But he's also an extremely talented director. He's made some great indie films, one called Dark Country that's one of my favorite films. And so he's a tremendous asset. We have Ruben Langdon, who not a lot of people know, but actually Ruben was if you watch the movie Avatar, you know, whenever Jake Sully is running or jumping or riding a dragon or doing any of that, he's actually, that's Ruben, you know,
okay.
Behind all the motion capture that was done for Avatar. So, you know, and he's been doing the Resident Evil game and all this stuff. So extremely talented guy. We're so fortunate to have supporting what we're doing. And Amardeep Kalika, who, is the director of the Sirius film, which is coming out now about Stephen Greer and Disclosure Project, and just also the larger world of Disclosure.
Mm-hmm.
I got to see a little previews of that, which is going to be a really fantastic, tremendous film. And Amar, who'd be a great person to have on your show sometime as well, is such a down-to-earth, and you know, he's just got a very high BS meter, and he pushes everybody to get really solid with what they're doing. And so I think he's going to be a tremendous asset to help unmuddy some of the waters on this issue of the ET and the contact and what's going on and what isn't.
Mm-hmm.
Not to say that anybody's got the definitive picture on that, but
sure. Oh yeah.
You know, and Amara, on an unfortunate note, for the, you know, I'm sure you heard about the shooting that happened in Wisconsin at the Sikh temple, or actually what's, I think the correct pronunciation is Sikh temple.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it was Amardeep's father who was actually the hero in that situation, who attempted to stop the gunman and was killed there. And so, you know, Amar has been all over in the media trying to expose, you know, what's going on in that situation as well. And so it's been very interesting to see how all these different energies are coming together. But, you know, the one thing I can say for him is that I know it's put him in a very real place. And with our project, that's what we're trying to do, is we're trying to cut the BS. We're trying to get to the reality. And yeah, I'm not going to sit here and tell you I've got the Ark of the Covenant in my garage. All right. You can see what's being done on YouTube. We're really putting our money where our mouth is, and we don't have the ultimate applications of this technology. But for anyone who knows what they're looking at, and I've had PhDs and multiple engineers confirming these things, people like Daniel, their results are simply impossible, and they don't they're not even projects that we've even been able to oversee or really get accurate with the math. But, you know, what he's been able to show is, like, the closer and closer you get to it, the better these things work. So with the proper application of technology in a truly open source project where the public was very involved and we all just have reasonable salaries to get us by and we devote our monies and our times instead of into expensive lifestyles they go into true open research and development, I believe that this project has the potential to completely take us to another level. And it's certainly on par with other things being researched. We've certainly demonstrated enough proof of concept. And so through the movie, we want to create an entertaining scenario where people can learn a little bit about the numbers and all that, but also learn about these applications. And we're presenting it as what it is right now, which is basically a street poor man's science. A science for the average person. You know, some people here where I live, they call it redneck science, and maybe that's true. But ultimately, I think that these are where the breakthroughs are going to come. Nobody's going to hand it down to us, regardless of what they may or may not already have.
Sure. Yeah, well, I like that in the intro video, and we're going to link that up too. But to your TED Talk there, in TED Talk X, we should say, in Charlotte there, when you... you know, have the speech there by Obama or whatever, he's talking about free energy or energy, the energy problem, I guess, in the fact that he says, like, well, if someone has anything, you know, please bring it to my attention, because we'd love to have it. Yeah, it's interesting. I just wonder if maybe they don't really know anything what really has been out there and how much has been suppressed. But it's great that you bring that in there, because obviously what your statement is there is that, well, we have something here that's potential, and with all the millions that have been poured into all the other, with wind and the whole Solera debacle and everything there. Again, I'm just flabbergasted that not just a little percentage of all the money that's being set aside can go to something which is within the alternative. They could even have their little committee there, whatever, that tries to at least find those who are, you know, serious in their attempts or whatever. But yeah, to me, it's incredible what the unwillingness of looking into new areas of what that is. That they want the answers, they want someone to just bring it to them, but they're not willing to kind of, I guess, put their money where their mouth is.
Yeah, and you know, I mean, it's hard to say who knows what. I'm sure things are very compartmentalized.
Sure.
You know, and I certainly don't know much when it comes to all that. I mean, I try to be educated, but, you know, there's a lot of mystery there. But I believe there's a lot of advanced flight technology, sure, and energy technologies. And there's been a lot of testimony around that. And the bottom line is, anyone who's sufficiently studied the UFO issue, and from really solid presenters like Richard Dolan and some of the people involved in the Disclosure Project, and, you know, a lot of the scientists and astronauts and all these people who testified, it's clear that this technology exists, you know, and so we're really sort of reverse engineering from that idea. You know, it certainly inspired me into understanding that this possibility was there. And what I see that is so powerful about vortex math, besides the fact that it's completely open, is the fact that it really provides an explanation that makes sense to people. And, you know, people say I just have all these people follow me around or convinced, but I'm very convinced that you can't just walk into a room and make the kind of claims that I've made and have people at least accept by the end of your talk that you may very well be onto something. And the fact that I've been able to do that both with lay people and professionals all over the world, you know, it speaks a lot for itself. Even with my lack of expertise in certain areas, the fact that I'm able to penetrate into the core concepts of what people are working on in these different fields and provide them new insights, I think is a powerful tool. And so, well, we're just trying to see it be further explored and investigated for the sake of all of us, because the truth is, there's a lot of great solutions and energy that we can focus on, and we should be working on many of them. But we're in so deep at this point, we've got to go for broke. We got to go for something major. Mm-hmm. It's really take something revolutionary to change our situation on the planet. Yeah. And perhaps to help get us off the planet, you know. And so I don't know. You know, we'll see how it goes.
Sure. All right. So... ultimately the point of the film is to bring attention to this knowledge, basically, and expand it from there. But where will people be able to find out more about the film? Is there any website set up about that yet, or are we still very, very far away from this being put into the actual film itself?
I'm not very far away. This stuff will all be going up at the latest within the next couple of weeks. But I would say really the best place for people to find out is to find me on Facebook. If you're on Facebook, or if you can even just get access to look at my page, I post up all the videos and all the things that are out there, anything that I'm endorsing or trying to share. I put it all up there, and I'll be promoting through there. And then we're going to be doing an online campaign. I'll certainly send you all the links, Heinrich. So if you post them up, people will be able to find them through your site. And we are going to do our best to get that information spread as far and wide as possible. And we'd like to get out there on coast to coast and a few other places, and try and keep spreading the word. So
definitely. All right, well, we're going to take a short break here now and continue with more in the second. We're hardly even getting started here. There's so much to discuss, and I'm going to ask you more later about how to take this knowledge from the theoretical to the practical and what the applications could be of all of this. And we'll get into some more detail of this, since it might seem somewhat elusive to you still at this point if you're new to the material, but we'll do our best to kind of get into the meat of this. But all right, in the meantime here then, the Abha Kingdom .com is the website. Check that out. Find Randy on Facebook, and we'll have all the links to that up on our website. So we'll be back with more. Stay with us. In the second hour, we'll discuss the geometry of the vortex coil. Randy says that there is a harmonic stability in the numbers and in the distribution of them around the circle or the sphere. Do stay with us in the second hour to learn more about something that could be an incredible breakthrough in many different fields, specifically the possibilities of new, clean, free energy technologies and over unity. At redicemembers.com, you can subscribe for a membership and get access to hundreds of hours of intriguing and controversial radio that we hope will help you to come to a greater understanding of life, reality, and of course the mysteries. But before we proceed, I want to let you know that we have Carol De La Herran from the Monroe Institute with us next on the program. After this, our roundtable with Scott, Kevin, and Dan. This is also on numbers, geometry, and relationships between natural landscape features on the Earth and also man-made structures. We are going to proceed after this with Richard Cassaro, Dean Clifford, John Lash, Richard Allen Miller, Johan Oldenkamp, Eric Karlström, G. Edward Griffin, David Talbot, and Rupert Sheldrake as well. But right now, more is coming up with Randy Powell. Stay with us.